terror and anxiety. But if you look into medieval pictures on the churches, it is very difficult to recognize Jesus the Nazarene in the world judge, with the condemned on the one side and the redeemed on the other side. Or if you go into the 16 chapel in the Vatican, what is the name?
Sistine
chapel in the Vatican, with a great picture of Michelangelo, with a great figure, I think more of Oedipus or one of the Greek heroes than of Christ, who's standing there as a big judge. Is this Jesus? I was always asking myself, looking at this picture, whenever I come to see it again, and then there's a small little cross behind it on a table. I say to myself, it's more like that than like this picture of the hero of God who will then judge the world. So we must perhaps Christianize the tradition of the final judgment, and not take the final judgment as we have it delivered also as a Christian tradition in the Egyptian form of the judgment of the dead. And to this belongs also that according to our traditional understanding, every one of us stands for himself or herself before the judge of the world, and then has to pay for his sins, or be delivered by his faith. I think it's more a social judgment, so that the victims and the perpetrators come together, and as it is said in the Old Testament, let God be the judge between you and me, so that the perpetrators in the eyes of the victims, and the victims vis-a-vis of the perpetrators, will receive justice. And this is, in my understanding, more like a correction and not a condemnation. But this is an open question, and with this open question, I hope to go on with your discussion.
Thank you very much. I'm wondering if any of the three of you would like to respond with a follow-up statement at all. I'm not... I don't know whether Dr. Noble is just writing a statement or he just...
Dr. Noble will now correct.
No, I wasn't too happy to accept that idea.
No, I think I won't respond at the moment. I'm just thinking about some things.
All right. I'd like to raise a question, particularly for Dr. Deasley and Dr. Noble, and then the other two of you can respond to that. It's very clear from the theology of hope, and then weave through the rest of Dr. Moltmann's work, that eschatology is not just another theological category, but it is a very central theological category. In our theological tradition, and I will say in perhaps the 19th and 20th century theological tradition, that we have not treated eschatology as central. In fact, in many ways, even in the theological life of the local church, many have avoided it simply because of all of the definitive kinds of eschatologies that seem to be there. I'm wondering if you could respond both from a theological standpoint, and then Dr. Deasley from a biblical standpoint and biblical preaching. I know you're teaching Revelation this semester. What are the problems that we face when we neglect eschatology? or to say that's really not central, or it's really not, I mean, it's kind of the add-on, and because we don't want to make definitive statements about it, then what are the perils that we face for its neglect? And then also, Dr. Deasley, for you, what are the perils that we face when we refuse to engage the eschatological texts, particularly the apocalyptical texts of Scripture, in serious and appropriate ways? I'll let you take that and then...
Well, I think the historic reason why many Anglo-Saxon evangelical Protestants have avoided eschatology is because of the whole tradition of millennialism and dispensationalism as it developed particularly here in the US. And therefore, since this seemed to be the only scheme that was available, we tended to avoid that and even perhaps relegate it to the appendix. in doing so, I think we probably shared the perspective of Western theology as a whole, which tended to shy clear of eschatology and leave it simply as the last chapter in the book, and failed to see that, as Dr. Maltman and others have taught us, this is the key in which the whole tune is set. And the consequence of that was that our whole Western Christian tradition was actually more influenced by Platonism and its dualism between eternity and time than we realized. And therefore, when we did talk about eschatology, we talked about it in very individualistic terms. And it became reduced simply to a symmetrical pattern of heaven and hell, in which the earth kind of disappears into this spiritually conceived future. The only question we would face in our evangelical preaching was, where are you going? It was very much individualized. I think the developments, first of all, in New Testament scholarship from Schweitzer onwards, and then in the way in which systematic theologians, particularly Professor Maltman, has picked this up, have shown us that this has got actually to be related to our whole concept of the relationship between time and eternity, the church, and social issues. So we have missed out on all that. We have been very individualized. We have been very Platonist, in fact. I preached at a funeral this last summer, where I used a popular book of some 60 years ago to raise the question, what happens after death? Some say nothing, humanism. Some say heaven or hell, or we all go to heaven, a kind of sentimentalized universalism. But this popular book of some 30 years ago said, no, the Christian answer begins with resurrection. And somebody said to me afterwards, I've never heard that preached before. We don't say much about resurrection. And so some of the things that have been developing in the theological world still have to percolate through to the pew, maybe even to the pulpit in some cases. So I think that's the way in which we actually end up by distorting the Christian gospel, by Platonizing it and individualizing it, if we don't have a good grasp of biblical eschatology.
I've always assumed that the systematic theologians were to blame. They looked up the word eschatology in the dictionary and saw that it meant the last thing, so they put them at the end of the book. What Dr. Noble, there's been very remarkable swing back and forth in the 20th century from the optimism with which the century began to the despair which it reached at the end of the First World War, which, if anything, was intensified by the Second World War, And remarkably, at that time, starting out, as Dr. Noble said, the Schweitzer, but continued by people like Dodd and Manson, for instance, to whom eschatology was a central biblical category. The kingdom is not merely something that is future. The kingdom is something that has that arrived with Jesus. In this way, eschatology, instead of being at the end of the line, as it were, was placed right at the center of the whole Christian message. And we are much in the debt of Professor Moltmann for having taken up this same theme in one of his earliest, perhaps his earliest work that I know anything about, The Theology of Hope, and made this the central category of his understanding of Christian theology. As to the other part of your question, what are the dangers of doing nothing about it, or not talking about the pop eschatological themes or reconstructions of things? Well, the best index of that is simply to look at the bestseller lists in the newspapers for the last 2 or 3 years. And whose books is it that have been at the top of the list of the bestsellers all the time? Tim LaHaye and Jerry Bridger. Jenkins. I have some of these books on my course syllabus in my course on the Book of Revelation, because I said to students, when you go out into parish ministry, they are the people who are determining what most of your parishioners think about these things. So you'd better find out what they think. Otherwise, you'll simply be in the wilderness.
Well, I don't really have much to add about much to add to what Professors Deasley and Noble have said. It also seemed to me that that what you actually do get is a dematerializing of the material world that was created for us. If you lose an emphasis on eschatology, and it not only happens in the church and in preaching, but it happens in the culture too. So that even in our culture that purports to value the material, the very ways that they go about attempting to do this are actually a devaluation of the material creation that we've been given. And I also just want to echo the great indebtedness that we have to Professor Moltmann for the resurrection of the... Well, the resurrection, right?
That's the bash.
Oh, thereabouts. The category of the eschatology. So.
I am not responsible for the resurrection. but it's very simple. In 1 Corinthians 13, the Apostle Paul says there are three virtues: faith, love, and hope. In the medieval times, we have big theological systems of caritas, love. Then in the Reformation time, to Schleiermacher, we have systems of faith. Now, what about hope? Immanuel Kant said, there are three questions: what can I know, what shall I do, what may I hope for? And the answer to this modern question, what may I hope for, is religion. And this is new, because in traditional societies, the past determines the present. In modern societies, the future determines the present. And therefore, many people ask the question, what is my future? What may I hope for? And you must answer this as a pastor, not only on the grave, but already in the midst of life. And therefore, I think it's the modern way of developing this underdeveloped sister of the three. Faith and love are big sisters, and hope is a very small sister. But without hope, faith and love don't know where to go. That's a problem.
I'm wondering at this point if there are some of you whose thoughts have been stimulated enough that you have a question or a comment that you'd like to make. Do we have the microphones there and ready to go? Or am I yet? Am I yet? Is there somebody around? Oh, there you go. Joel, I think right there.
My question is for Dr. Moltmann. Excuse me for skipping over the panel discussion. I wanted to ask something about something you said at the end of the morning session. You said we needed a global endeavor to eliminate poverty. And my question is, because of the sin nature, what would keep a global endeavor uncorrupted? How could we do that without it going the way of so many endeavors, following the will of some charismatic leader who will use it for his own ends? How could we have a global endeavor for that worthy goal without it becoming corrupted?
Well, in the modern world we have eliminated a number of plagues and diseases. Why can we not eliminate the disease of poverty? There's enough for everyone in the world. It's a question of distribution. And of course there's corruption everywhere, but this should not hinder us to do something. We can correct then the corruption again if it happens, but this should not hinder us. Sometimes the preaching of the sinfulness of the human being is paralyzing every action. And then everything is in sin, and this is a darkness where all the cats are dark, and you cannot distinguish things anymore. I think this is a wrong use of the doctrine of the corruptibility or the sinfulness of human beings.
We had a question right here, Greg. Joel, Greg, go ahead and stand if you would, so you can see where he's bringing.
I wanted to probe a little further the question that Dr. Deasley brought up about our aligning ourselves with political causes as Christians. Where do we stand in relationship to those who want to bring about justice, others in the world besides Christians, perhaps specifically in the situation that we found ourselves in now? And I was intrigued particularly because I happen to be one of those people at the nonviolent protests, and I'm a Christian pacifist, and I found myself there feeling very ambivalent because my pacifism is rooted in Christology, and I think Trinitarian thinking and ecclesiology, and some of the language that I heard calling for nonviolent solutions, some of the rhetoric didn't sound that much different than the folk who are speaking from the other side of the issue that are wanting to use, or at least open to, the tragic use of having to use violence. And I was pushed back to the question again, what does it mean for me to be politically engaged and active as a Christian? To see what God is doing in the world and align myself where God calls me to align myself, specifically where Christ calls me to be. And I also happen to be a chaplain at a rescue mission where we work with homeless men. And the thing that I continue to come to is that I see the world changing and I see the kingdom coming more in my being bodily present with the poor and being friends with the poor and opening myself up to that than I often do in the way I cast my ballot or in the nonviolent activism that I might be involved in. I'm not sure where all my motivations are for that. And I want to hear more discussion about how we work from our theological paradigm to see where we can align ourselves with folk. I would like some help with that, because I don't just want to talk about having solidarity with the poor and all that. And I don't want to talk about the poor just as the poor and me coming to save them, because I'm not the Savior. Is that clear?
Professor Knight, why don't you start out the conversation
okay.
on that
one? Well, Greg, the issue seems to me about how to go about aligning ourselves with political causes. I suppose there's a number of different issues that you could identify, but the most important and overriding one would seem to be me to be the issue of idolatry. The question is, are you following the will of Christ, the rule of Christ, and establishing God's righteousness and justice, or not? A lot of the sort of activism, I don't necessarily mean in the demonstration in which you were involved, but that I have seen around. Since September 11th in the United States, has to be seen as somewhat idolatrous, really. And I don't want to pass on the issue of pacifism now, or on whether we should respond, or whether this bombing is correct or not. But I do remember traveling down a road. Maybe it was the day after. And going underneath a bridge, and there were people up waving flags, so three or four different flags. One of them was huge, and one of them was a Christian flag, and the others were American flags. And I thought how easy it is for us who are Americans to think that what it means to be a Christian is just to be an American. And one of the reasons that I'm trying to push for the notion of a tragic category in theology is that this is a blindness that we are all susceptible to. It just so happened in this particular demonstration, the Christian flag, whatever you think about Christian flags, which is another issue in itself, was somewhat subordinated to the American flag, which I thought again was somewhat symbolic. So maybe the rest of you all have something to say.
Well, as a Christian, I belong to a worldwide Christian community, and as a Christian in Germany, I belong to the German Republic and to the European community, and sometimes there are loyalty conflicts between the two. I think I'm not a German Christian, but I'm a Christian who happens to be a German. To be a Christian is more important for me than to be a German. As a member of a worldwide Christian community, we should know about developing crises earlier than other people if we would develop the worldwide Christian community into a kind of world watch system. And sometimes we know better than politicians, at least in my country, what's going on in other countries, because our brothers and sisters live there and they tell us about the situation. If a situation deteriorates,
it ends up in violence. So you must go in to solve problems in a situation before the deterioration goes so far down that violence erupts. We have had these experiences in the Balkan, for example, and there are other spots in the world where we have solved the problem before it came to violence, but now in Afghanistan the situation was so far deteriorated that violence erupted, and then we must try to stop this. At the moment, I must confess that I don't like the cry for peace in Germany. Peace, peace, peace. Everybody now cries out for peace. But I remember there in the prophet Jeremiah some false prophets who cry peace, 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 and there is no peace. So the basis for peace, in my understanding, is righteousness and justice according to the standards of human rights as we have it at the moment. Work for justice, work for human rights, and then peace will be the fruit of it, but not the other way around. To pacify things at the moment would not help. It would give us perhaps a little more time to work for justice, but that's an all. So I was a member of the peace movement in Germany when the building up of the nuclear powers east and west was so high that we were under real danger. But at the moment, I would prefer the word justice or righteousness according to human rights to the word peace.
Good, thank you. Question right here. Colin, go ahead.
Your talk of justice and peace, I guess it's open to anybody. I guess when I hear about people talking about justice and peace here in America, at least, a lot of times it justifies a lot of evils. And it seems like, I guess I'm trying to understand better what you're saying, and maybe a clarification of what you mean by justice and righteousness, and often that could resort to violence, and where violence plays, is allowed or not allowed in our seeking justice and righteousness.
Yeah, Colin, if I'm make sure that we're hearing your question correctly. The tension that's created when sometimes justice and righteousness either evolve into or require what we might refer to as violence. Is there a just violence? Is there a righteous violence? Or is peace the highest of the virtues? And I did think you said that was open to everybody, right? Okay.
Torn as to whether I ought to say what I'm about to say, because for one thing, I'm not a U.S. citizen, and I, as a matter of principle, keep my distance from U.S. politics because I don't have the right to speak to U.S. politics, or so it seems to me. I've been particularly impressed, this may come as less than a surprise to you, but I don't mean it in any with any sense of levity, by the speeches of the British Prime Minister since the September the 11th crisis began, in which he has very clearly attempted to inject a note of moral principle into his response to this situation, because he has aligned, not against their will, the British people squarely with the people of the United States in their response to this matter. But he has very impressively, it seems to me, set out his principles and then gone right down the middle of the world situation, not merely apropos of the terrorist situation. For example, in what was acclaimed by the leading newspaper in Britain, which criticizes and opposes him as his finest hour, he started out by stating that those orange men who threw missiles at little children when they were on their way to school, which compelled them to walk down a street through a Roman Catholic district, they were a disgrace to the United Kingdom, and that is the ultimate insult that you can pay to any Orangeman. He then moved on from there to the president of Zimbabwe, whom he referred to not as Mr. Mugabe, let alone President Mugabe, but Mugabe and his henchmen. And it's Mugabe whom he will be sitting across the table from in 2 weeks' time at the Commonwealth Prime Minister's Conference. He went on to go further back and say that he thought, he believed, that the silence and inaction of Britain in the Rwanda crisis of 7 years ago was a disgrace, and that if it happened today, that Britain wouldn't remain silent as it did then. Now, I find it difficult not to find something preferable in that kind of attempt, which, after all, in a world like this, and this is what lay behind my question, how do Christians live as agents of the new creation when we ourselves are caught up in the contradictions of the old creation? I find it difficult not to see something preferable in that kind of approach than in any alternative approach which I have heard. He is being guided by moral principle. He is a confessed Christian. He is being guided by moral principle at that point. I think if he were here, that he would say that he, in his office, very often discovers that he doesn't have the choice to make between alternative good ways of doing things, but only a choice between what is bad and what is less bad. But sometimes one finds oneself compelled to make that kind of choice. And in those situations, for my part, I find that to be an uncomfortable, but nonetheless acceptable guideline to follow.
We have a question here, and then one right here, and those will probably be the last two for this afternoon.
I too have appreciated Tony Blair's statesmanship and Dr. Deasley's comments, but I still think that since we give Israel $3 billion each year for her war machine and $800 million each year just to spend, And since she took these Palestinian areas by war in 67 and 73, not being content with what was given in 47 and what was doubled by war in 48, it seems to me that the politicians in America, both Democratic and Republican, are hoodwinked by powerful Zionists. And I think that if we would not only simply ask for a state, as our president has done, but tell Israel that we will not give them this money each year, and let the world know that we won't give it anymore, and even then, if that's as far as it would go, the Arabs, I think, would appreciate that very much, and might not be as much prone to terrorism.
I think I'm correct in that I don't think there was a question in there. That was very much a statement. Thank you, Dr. Greider. We have one here, and then we have one more. You know, okay, back there, Dr. Lott.
Dr. Moldman, I liked something you said this morning when you said you talked about looking at ourselves through the eyes of third world countries, and to be able to validate and identify, give cultural identity. And I think this is a good time for America and all of us to perhaps look at ourselves through the eyes of other smaller countries. Countries that are impoverished, countries that are doing without, and perhaps to look at ourselves through the eyes of perhaps the minorities in America, and to begin to gather that information and find out what we could do as a result of that. Perhaps all of it is not negative, and perhaps we can do something from there. So I appreciated your comments. God bless you.
Thank you. Any closing words or comments from the four of you that you'd like to make briefly as we come to an end?
Just a brief one, and that is the phrase moral ambiguity comes through to me, that while there is a sense of moral... Oh, yes, I can't use that word. There's a sense of moral purpose. One would trust shaping our policy, yet other people perceive moral issues differently. And I think a key question which we in the West need to ask is, why do these people hate us so much? And I'm not just referring to the Bin Laden group, but the people in the streets of Pakistan and Jakarta and so on who are protesting and rioting today. Why do these people hate us so much? That's an absolutely crucial question that we have to ask. To balance that, it does not seem to me that poverty is always the result of oppression, and that riches are always at the cost of someone else's poverty. I think there's a kind of mercantilist idea of economics back there that we need to draw away from. I think there is the possibility in increased production for all to benefit. It is a question, as Professor Moltmann has said, of distribution, and something which our society needs to address very seriously.
Just to respond to the last comment, not Professor Noble's comment, but regarding the importance of seeing ourselves through the eyes of the countries of the two-thirds world and through the eyes of minorities, I suppose my own feeling is that we're not able to do that. And so this is the very reason why they need a seat at the table. Why we need to engage in dialogue with people from the countries of the two-thirds world.
and why those of us who are Caucasians or European Americans need to engage in dialogues with minorities and those who are poor in our own country. So.
Well, I would underline your statement. The question, why do they hate us so much, cannot be answered by ourselves. Go out and ask them, and then come into that dialogue, and then try to understand their situation and how they see us. So it's not an opportunity to fall into self-pity. That would be a trap.
I think you would like to join me in thanking these four for their contribution for us this afternoon.